Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Whole Scoop. Remember, we're a health and wellness radio show where our guests are always highly credentialed in their fields. We present opposite perspectives at times, and we allow our listeners to make informed decisions about what might be the right approach for them. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian who has practiced for over 30 years and the founder of Naturally Nutrition Inc., and you will find me at NaturallyNutritionInc.com. As always, it's important for me to provide you with highly qualified guests on a variety of topics. Tonight's no exception. Tonight's show is The Importance of Healthcare Advocacy and Why It Could Save Your Life. The number to call in is 347-855-8894. You can also direct questions and comments to www.blogtalkradio.com/The Whole Scoop. And remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Blog Talk, and Blog Talk Radio. We look forward to your comments on Facebook, and we look for new and exciting ideas and what you might be looking for from us. So, again, the call-in number is 347-855-8894, and we will be taking questions later on in the show. At that time, I'll be calling out the last four digits of your telephone number, and if you are calling in with a question, please remember to press the number 1 in order to become part of the queue for questions. And tonight, again, our show is The Importance of Healthcare Advocacy and Why It Could Save Your Life. And I'm so very honored to tell you that who we have tonight. We have Ms. Tricia Torrey, and Tricia is known as Every Patient's Advocate. She is an author, blogger, patient advocacy consultant, and a national speaker. With a background prior to her advocacy work in teaching and marketing, in 2009, Tricia founded the AdvoConnection.com, which is A-D as in dog, V as in Victor, O, Connection.com. A directory that helps patients and caregivers find private health advocates who can help them get the good health care they deserve. The advocates found in the directory are all members of the Alliance of Professional Health Advocates, an organization she founded in conjunction with the Advo Connection, which provides business support to private, professional, independent patient advocates. Tricia has written 6 books. 2 of her books, the You Bet Your Life series, help patients and caregivers understand how to navigate through the healthcare system. Her other books, the Healthcare Advocates Career series, support the business needs of the private independent patient advocates. Tricia has appeared on or has been quoted by the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, CNN, NPR, USA Today, Money Magazine, Fox News, MSNBC, O Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, and other media. You'll learn more about Tricia's expertise at her websites, and she's got 3 of them, www.healthadvocateresources.com, www.youbetyourlifebooks.com, and www.everypatientsadvocate.com. Now, we'll be giving those out again, but right now, we should bring Tricia on and say hello. Tricia, are you with us?
I am. How are you this evening, Carol?
I'm good. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you tonight. What you do
thank you for
so
the invitation.
thank you. What you do is so very important. It's just mind-boggling with some of the things that are happening out there. I mean, everyone that listens to this show knows that I've been in healthcare for a long time. But even me, I was just astounded. I mean, I knew this was an important topic, and frankly, everybody, I'm kind of going through this at the moment personally. This is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. But even at that, I usually start this show with statistics. I'm going to give you statistics tonight, and it's probably going to be a little more than usual because I just feel that strongly that you need to understand what Tricia does is just so absolutely essential. So, Tricia, give me a second here. I'm going to give some statistics out, okay?
And while you get them out, let me just point out that I don't want to take any credit where credit is not due. The actual heroes are the people who work one-on-one with patients and help them, patients and caregivers, and help them get through the system. I work with them to help them help patients. So let's make sure that they're the heroes of the story. I'm just happy to tell you about them.
All right, you got it. You got it. We'll make sure to make that distinction tonight for sure, because it is important. So anyway, everybody, here's how it goes. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine reported that up to 98,000 people die each year due to hospital mistakes. That was in 1999. Skipping up to September 2015, it's reported that most people will suffer from at least one wrong or delayed medical diagnosis during their lifetime. And Americans experience about 12 million diagnostic errors a year. That's what was revealed for now. Conservatively, that same report found that 5% of U.S. adults who seek outpatient care will experience a diagnostic error, and such errors are thought to contribute to 10% of patient deaths and 17% of adverse events in the hospitals. They're also the leading type of paid medical malpractice claims. There's a doctor named Peter Provenos, who's the director of the Armstrong Institute of for Patient Safety and Quality at Johns Hopkins, and he says, and I'm quoting him now, it's probably one of the, if not the, most under-recognized issues in patient safety. Much of the harm that we once labeled as inevitable, we now see as preventable. So those are big words. That's a huge statement to make from someone that's been in the system for as long as he has. Who's mainly at risk? Everybody. But who are the targets? Seniors and children. And there's a doctor who works with Dr. Provenos, and he is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare, which is a story about dangerous practices and mistakes. And he says, one of the best suggestions is simply to have someone there to act as your personal advocate or to take the time to stay with your loved one who is hospitalized. This is particularly important for pediatric patients and the elderly. And he goes on to say, these are high-risk areas for medical mistakes. So I could give you more. I'm not going to go into all the statistics, but seriously, this is something that you should check out. This is something that you should be aware of. Anybody that has anything to do with some kind of issue in the healthcare system, these are statistics that you should at least have in your head. So, Tricia, that being said, let's just talk about what the role of an advocate is. I mean, you in your bio, you use the words navigating through the healthcare system, and I thought that was just absolutely apropos because you do have to navigate, and you've got to know how to do that, or someone needs to, right?
Oh, absolutely true. So one of the very first things we talk about in terms of patients accessing the healthcare system, and by the way, I want to add to your statistics, sure. The Institute of Medicine report that you gave that came out in 1999 was then updated and published in the Journal of Patient Safety in 2014, and that number is now 440,000 Americans who die every year from medical errors and misdiagnoses. So it's just an outrageous, outrageous number. What they used to say was that the number of people who die in hospitals of patient safety, patient safety, or what they call never events, although the medical system hates them to be called never events, plus the number of people who die from infections would be the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every day. So can you imagine if that was on the news? Yeah, I mean,
wow.
It's just unreal. So yes, that's exactly why you need to have an advocate by your side. And by the way, those statistics are all about hospitals. They're not about just what's going on out on the street. Certainly diagnoses don't typically take place in a hospital. They might under emergency conditions, for instance, or if there's some kind of exploratory surgery that's going on. But often misdiagnoses take place right in the doctor's office. And you don't know what you don't know. And that's actually maybe the key that we talk to patients and caregivers about. You don't know what you don't know. And if you think the system is set up to help you and to cure you and to make things better for you, you are sorely mistaken. That's a nice side effect when it happens. But most of the time, the system is only set up to make money, and you actually have to be very proactive to take care of yourself in the system to get what you need. It's there. You just have to work to get what you need.
So if but I think, you know, what you just said about the hospitals versus what's happening out on the street, and I'm gonna take a jump there about defining the street. And the street could be people in their doctor's offices and not feeling well and not really getting that diagnosis that they're seeking because it's not, nobody's really paying attention these days. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know if you know why I do the work I do, but I do it because I was misdiagnosed. I was misdiagnosed in 2004 after a small tumor about the size of a golf ball was removed from my torso. And I was told that I had terminal lymphoma and only a few months to live.
Oh, wow.
And the very short part of the story is I figured out on my own that I didn't have lymphoma, and that was eventually confirmed by the National Institutes of Health. But what I had to do to get through the system, to figure that out. And I only did it because I felt like I'd been backed into a corner and I was scared. I didn't have a healthcare advocate. That's actually what the genesis of all of this was for me, was, oh my gosh, had I not advocated for myself in the ways that I did, I never could have gotten through the system. I would have ended up having chemo or radiation or something I didn't need for a malignancy I didn't have. So, and on the other end, the doctors who would have been, who would have quote unquote cured me of an incurable cancer would have been heroes instead of being recognized for the mistakes they had made. So, yeah, so that's where I started. I really get this, and that's absolutely why I started working in this health advocacy space, recognizing exactly what people needed to have. And you're right, it starts in the doctor's office. It might be as simple as a test that's not done correctly and therefore the results are incorrect. It could be as simple as something that there's not a simple test for and the doctor just takes a guess. It can even be something that the doctor doesn't believe in, if you can believe that. Would you believe in this day and age there are still doctors that don't think Lyme disease exists? And
I
yet
did
people
a series on Lyme disease, so
yeah.
I'm right there with you. I understand.
And if somebody goes to a doctor who doesn't believe in Lyme disease, they're not going to get the right diagnosis if that's what they've got. So self-defense reasons, you know, we just need to be aware that we need to stay on top of it and take responsibility for getting all the answers we can get and then making our own decisions.
Well, the thing about it is I see that, I mean, the children and the elderly are targets, but if we just go take a step backwards and we go with the elderly, that particular population was raised on, if you have MD behind your name and you wear a white coat, everything that you say I'm going to listen to regardless, and I'm never going to question you. So that also is a huge part of this problem, because they're not questioning, they trust. And and I would love to be able to say, yes, absolutely trust your doctor, absolutely go for it. But in today's world, would you agree that you just can't do that? You have to ask.
Well, here's the thing. What I say is trust but verify. And so nobody wants to think that their doctor is going to make a mistake or is going to intentionally give them bad information. We just don't want to think that's true. And I honestly don't believe that most doctors do want to give the wrong answers, although we just had the case of the doctor in Michigan, the oncologist in Michigan, who diagnosed more than 500 people with cancer they didn't really have. So he could build Medicare. He's now in prison for 40 years, not because he killed people or made them sicker, but because he committed Medicare fraud and insurance fraud. And so that's why he's in prison. Yeah, so it can happen, but
Medicare,
I think that's unusual.
That's great.
Yeah. To your point, this is about trusting but verifying, and there are many things you can do to verify the information you're being given.
Okay, so let's just back it up a little bit and just let's just define the advocacy role. What is an advocate? There are different types of advocates. We've got, you know, the healthcare versus the private versus the patient advocate and insurance advocates and all kinds of advocates. So what is it that you do, and how does that all play a role into what everybody else does?
Okay. Well, there are all kinds of advocates, as you just said, and that starts with loved ones, family members, friends, neighbors who know something about helping you get through the healthcare system or at least are there to ask questions on your behalf. And they're usually volunteers. They may or may not know anything about the healthcare system and how it really operates and how to get around it, which is often what needs to be done. But they can be there to help you. And so that's, you know, a beginning step. And at the very least, you need somebody like that helping you, especially if you're going to be hospitalized. Because the minute you're hospitalized, of course, you're out of it most of the time. Either you've had surgery or they're giving you some kind of pain drugs or whatever it's going to be. So that's kind of the, I hate to use the term lowest level. I think volunteers are wonderful things, but that's maybe the least skilled kind of advocate we can use. And then you can go from there. There will be advocates that work for hospitals, advocates that work for insurance companies. Those advocates you have to beware because they're being paid by those hospitals and they're being paid by those insurance companies. And if you think of what hospitals are exist for, they exist to help patients, of course, but they exist to stay in business. And so their advocates typically, not in all cases, I actually was corrected by one advocate 6 months or so ago, because she said this wasn't true for her, but every other advocate from a hospital I've ever met actually works for the risk management department. That's the legal department. So their role is really to kind of keep the hospital out of hot water. Insurance advocates, so they're working for a company whose job it is to make sure that they don't pay for anything any more than they absolutely have to. And so the insurance advocate's role is to make sure that you get what you need, maybe within the letter of the law, but the more they can deny you care or not tell you about the expensive possibilities, the more they're rewarded. And so they may or may not be able to serve your purposes.
Let me just stop you right there and define reward, because and a lot of times, am I correct in thinking that that's in a bonus format?
I don't want to say that. I don't know that to be true for a fact. I've heard that that's true. I have heard that sometimes it's not just money. I've heard that there is a reward system, but because I don't have any proof myself, I hate to go out on making claims that I'm not sure can be true. So, but if you stop and think about it, just the very idea of if an insurance advocate is working for the insurance company and the insurance company only survives when they deny as much care as they can, well, you know, you can kind of go from there. The key here is not whether or not they can be helpful, because to an extent, they all can. The problem is we have to be smart about it, and we need to know that when we go to the hospital with certain kinds of complaints, they're not going to be happy, and we're probably not going to get the relief we need from our complaint. And the same is going to be true with an insurance company. You know, they deny a test or a procedure. Well, you know, sometimes the only thing you need to do is call back the next day and talk to a different rep, and you might get a different answer. So it's not an exact science, but there are people who are professionals at doing this. There are professionals helping you navigate the system in whatever way it needs to be navigated, whether that's getting through a difficult diagnosis, whether that's helping you choose the right treatment option for you, not the one that can make the doctor's practice the most money, but rather the thing that you decide is right. They might help you. They might sit by your bedside in the hospital to make sure that there's less of a chance you'll get an infection or less of a chance. The big one in hospitals is that you are given the wrong drug at the wrong time. Sometimes it's given to the wrong person. Drug errors are the most prevalent errors in hospitals. And then somebody who can help you with your bills afterwards. There might be mistakes. You might have been billed for something that was not a service you received. You might be covered for something, and insurance denied it. In fact, it should not have denied it, and so you need somebody to go to bat for you at the insurance company. And everything in between, whatever all those peripheral non-medical things are, there is an advocate somewhere who can help you.
Interesting, because, you know, I think we have a tendency to forget what happens after the fact. Let's fast forward to the hospital. You're a patient in the hospital, and you go through the entire experience, whether you have surgery, whether you needed to do whatever, and then you come home and you're faced with all these bills and you don't know where to turn and you still don't feel well and you're still not up to par. So now you have all of this other stuff to deal with on top of it. And I think we tend to forget that. I think we tend to not think about it after, you're out of the hospital, you're better now. And it's not necessarily true.
Well, one of the biggest, there are two things actually to share with you about hospitals, but one of them is that one of the biggest problems occurs at discharge. So you've got someone who has been treated in the hospital. They may still have some drug in their system that doesn't really help them process things with clarity the way they would if they didn't have that drug in their system, or they may still be in pain or whatever the problem might be. And the nurse comes in or someone comes in and sits down and says, okay, Mr. Smith, now we're sending you home with a prescription for this and this and this. Make sure you get them filled this afternoon. You need to stay off your feet as much as you can. And they go into this whole long explanation of what Mr. Smith needs to know. Well, Mr. Smith isn't processing well. Smith goes home and doesn't remember anything, doesn't remember that there are prescriptions to fill, doesn't remember that he's not supposed to go out and take the garbage cans out the next morning. You know, whatever Mr. Smith has always done, he's being told not to do, and he's not processing that well. So discharge is a huge thing. Discharge also ties into another problem, and it's one of the blessings and curses, let's say, of the ACA. So for the most part, people are really better off now because of the ACA in general, because they've got coverage for a lot of things they didn't have coverage for before. But within the Medicare system, there have been some problems for hospitals, and one of the things the ACA said to hospitals was, if you discharge a patient who's on Medicare and that patient returns to the hospital within 30 days, we will not reimburse you for anything you do to take care of that patient.
Wow.
And so stop and think about that for a minute. So they discharge an older patient who goes home. It doesn't have any way of taking care of him or herself. What happens? They end up back in the hospital. First of all, the rule says that the hospital can't bill the patient by law for that treatment. Do you think the hospital is going to provide what that patient really needs if they can't be reimbursed for it?
Right.
I mean, it's such a perverse... The idea was a good idea to begin with. The idea was you're discharging patients too early. They're getting home and they have infections, and now they have to come back in to be treated. Why should we have to pay when you didn't do it right to begin with? They should have gotten the infection. So the idea was good, but the unintended consequence is something that now means that many patients who, again, Medicare patients for the most part, but I should say the private insurance is looking very carefully at this. So what's happening is hospitals are bringing patients in, but they are not actually admitting them. They're bringing them in under something they call observation status. And if you go out there and do a search for observation status, you will see so many articles about this. What it means is Medicare is not going to pay for it.
Right.
So a patient's in the hospital for 2 or 3 days, gets home and gets a bill for tens of thousands of dollars because they were never truly admitted. And they weren't admitted because the fear was once they were discharged, they would come back.
And let me tell you, I can personally attest to that, because over the summer my father ended up in the hospital and he was admitted under observation status. And he was there for 5 long days under observation status, and I knew what that meant. So it took me 2 full days to get that converted, because I knew that if I didn't work it and I didn't work with the staff to get that converted, my parents were going to get an astronomical bill for 5 days in the hospital that nobody was paying for.
Well, you get so much credit for making the call on that, because it's highly unusual for somebody who's not a professional advocate to even know to look for that. So, wow, Carol, you get so many points for that. That is great that you did that. Yeah, here's the next problem is that say these patients they come in and maybe they're admitted. An administrator who knows nothing about the patient can go in and change the status.
What? No, say that one again.
I will say it again. So a patient might be admitted the way they're supposed to be admitted to the hospital, and an administrator can go in later and change the status so that that patient is now observation status, not admitted.
And how, okay, now that one I didn't know. And what I'm trying to wrap my head around is what, how, I'm even speechless on that, and that's hard to make me speechless.
Well, it gives you that sense. It's exactly what I said when we got started. You don't know what you don't know. So you don't even know how to ask the questions, and you can't begin to figure out how to fix something when you don't know the questions to ask. So
right,
there you
but
go.
How
There's
does an administrator justify, I guess that's where it's coming from, like how can they possibly justify an admission status, a bona fide diagnosis and admission, and then switch it over to observation? How do they justify that, and how do they get away with that?
I don't even know how to answer that question. We just have reports, including in the press, so this isn't stuff that, you know, I've just heard on the streets or something like that. Even in the press where people have observed this, among our members of our Alliance of Professional Health Advocates, this is discussed in forums where people, one advocate comes in and says, you know, I just found out that my patient who's been in the hospital for 3 days has had her status changed. What do I do? And other people will say, you know, go here, go here, go here, and you should be able to change it back. But if you don't know to do that, or if you don't have someone to do it for you, it's not going to get done, and you're going to get that bill.
And you can't just assume, like a lot of people assume that you can just call an attorney and an attorney will tell you what to do. Okay, well, first of all, that's very costly, and we're going to talk about cost here in a minute. But even if you call an attorney, it doesn't mean that they know exactly what to do, which is why you guys are just so important. You know, people need to understand who you are and what you do. That being said, before you answer that or before you have a comment to that, I want to remind everybody you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, licensed registered dietitian and founder of Naturally Nutrition, Inc. You can check me out at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Tonight's show is The Importance of Healthcare Advocacy and Why It Can Save Your Life with Tricia Torrey, who is the patient advocate, and you'll find her at three different websites, so she's very accessible, www.healthcareadvocateresources.com, www.youbetyourlifebooks.com, and or www.everypatientsadvocate.com. And we will be taking questions later on in the show, a little bit later, where I call out the last four digits of your telephone number. If you are going to ask a question, remember to press the number one. I'm seeing some people on the board tonight. I'm not seeing any questions. So if you are pressing one and I'm not seeing it, so blog in and let me know that you're pressing one, because we have had issues with that in the past. I want to make sure that we aren't having another issue tonight. And if we are, then get your questions out on the blog and we'll do the best we can tonight. So Tricia, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt that much, so let's just get back to it.
Let's do it.
Okay, so all that being said, what is the cost of an advocate? How do you find an advocate? Most people wait until the last minute, or most people just don't even realize it until they're in the middle of it and they go, oh my gosh, what do I do now? Because this is completely, totally overwhelming. It used to be that you'd go into the hospital or you'd see your doctor and you'd just be prepared for not understanding what they said, because medical ease is a totally different language, and a lot of us practitioners have trouble with, you know, bringing it down to what other people can understand. Now we're talking about an entire mammoth system that, as you just well defined, any little intricate thing can change, and you're the one that has to pick up the cost, pretty much. And if you're not picking up just the cost, you may be suffering the consequences to misdiagnosis, someone not really understanding or seeing what has actually been done with you, and then missing something that is essentially important. Your case in particular, where you have this, but you don't really, and then what do you do? How do you do? And so let's just take it apart a little bit, okay?
Sure. Well, I think there are some simple ways you can recognize when it's time to find an advocate. And I actually use the metaphor of, you know, suppose you're out driving home from dinner one night and you get pulled over and hauled off to jail. Well, you know, it's not, going to jail isn't something you do very often, if ever, right? When you get there,
right,
you have no clue. You don't understand why you're there. You're not even sure where you are, perhaps, because you've been hauled off to jail, but who knows, you know, what the jail looks like. If you've been inside a paddy wagon somewhere, you might not know where they've dumped you out, where they've taken you in. You don't know anything about the penal system. You don't know how you're going to get out. You know, you've heard from TV that you get a phone call, but who are you supposed to call? All of these questions, you don't know because you don't know. You've never been in that situation before. So the answer is you call a lawyer. And a lawyer is the person who knows that system and is going to make sure you make bail, you get sent home, you show up for hearings, whatever needs to take place to get you out of that corner you've been backed into, the lawyer is going to guide you through. So the healthcare system should be the same way. Doctors have always been the person who, when all of a sudden we were feeling strange symptoms or whatever, was going to guide us through the system and make sure we got what we needed. Unfortunately, the system has shifted in ways that even doctors aren't allowed to do it the way they want to do it anymore. And most of them would tell you that they would do it totally differently if they didn't have these incentives in place. And when I say incentives, often they are backwards incentives. You know, you want to keep your job, you will do it this way. They're not, you'll make all this money if you do it this way. So doctors are as cornered by this system as we are. I don't say any of this to dog on doctors. They're stuck too. So what are you supposed to do? So enter advocates. And in the case we're talking about tonight, we're talking mostly about private advocates. And the reason we're talking about private advocates is because just like you wouldn't trust the internet to get you out of jail or your sister to get you out of jail or somebody who doesn't really know what they're doing to get you out of jail, you shouldn't be trusting just anybody to get you through the healthcare system either. You need a professional. And this whole group of professionals have arisen. These are people who either come from a clinical background, so they were nurses or doctors to begin with, and decided they don't like the way the system operates anymore, and so they want to work just as advocates. Or there are people who have been through the system themselves, either for a loved one or for themselves, somebody like me who got myself through the system. And now what we do is we help individuals get through the system too. We know the questions to ask. We know what needs to be done next. We know if you've gotten a bad diagnosis and you're scared to death, what to do next. All of those kinds of things. So because they're private, there is a cost. You pay out of your pocket for them. And I can't really give you a total what the cost is. I don't know. You know, it's different everywhere. It's different based on your geography. It's more expensive in some of the big cities than it is in smaller towns and rural areas. It's more expensive depending on the services you need. If you just need somebody to sit by your bedside for, you know, 8 hours a day, that's not going to cost you nearly what it's going to cost you to have somebody who accompanies you to doctor's appointments, helps you ferret out the treatment options and goes through a shared decision-making process with you. It's also not going to cost the same as somebody who's going to reconcile your medical bills and maybe pull that $20,000 off the hospital bill that was wrong. So the general cost is really tough to tell, but we talk about it as what's the value of this kind of thing. So, you know, if you're diagnosed with something and they're telling you you need chemo, you really need to get somebody in there. And even if it costs you $500, $1,000 to find out what all your other options are so that you're making the decision and you have confidence in the decision, well, is that an expensive cost? For some people it would be, absolutely. But for others it's like, oh, really? Oh, my gosh, absolutely it's worth that to me.
Well, you know, I'm just going to interject something here because, again, I mean, I can't even believe how personal this is for me. But there's a friend of the family whose father-in-law is going through some issues with some cancer and having some low platelet issues. And there's a new drug that's being used that he's asked to use. And the cost is $10,000 a month. $10,000. And it can be subsidized, it may not be subsidized, blah, 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 blah. But he didn't have a choice to say, give me a minute to figure out this this whole thing or have an advocate on his side to look at the drug and say, these are the side effects, this is what could happen to you, or this is what we can find to say, you know, this might be worse before, or it might be worse for you as opposed to better. And now he took out $10,000, and it turns out his cost is actually $14,000. And I'm talking a month. I'm not saying $10,000 forever. I'm saying $14,000 a month for the prescription. And his platelets actually went lower, and he's actually worse. And we're just waiting to see how he actually does. And I'm listening to you, and I'm saying, if he had had someone on his side and he was able to utilize someone as an advocate to kind of say, wait a minute, let's hold the phone here and let's look at this and let's get some questions answered before we just jump into this, where might he be now, you know?
Exactly right. So first of all, he did have a choice, but I'm going to guess that he's older and didn't understand that he could actually stop the process and say, no, wait, I need to get
That's
more
true.
Information before I make this decision. He was also, in advocacy, we talk about the fudge factor. I call it the fudge factor. Fear, uncertainty, doubt, guilt, and exhaustion.
Absolutely true.
Again.
Yeah.
Fear, uncertainty, doubt, guilt, and exhaustion, the fudge factor. So anywhere in that fudge factor, we tend to make poor choices. We tend to make them based on our fear or our uncertainty or our doubt, and not based on facts, and not based the way they would be if our heads were clearer, you know, when we're not sick, the clarity we would have then. So an advocate is the person who steps in under any of those circumstances and guides you toward the decision you would make when you have clarity. So I would also say to you that some of these drugs that they're talking about, especially post-cancer treatments, I've not heard about them in radiation treatments, but I can imagine that they could come up then too. They're new drugs. They've probably been approved by the FDA. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been suggested. But they may be in what they call post-approval stage, which means that the FDA has said, yeah, there's enough evidence to say this might work. Go ahead and give it a try and let us know how it works out. And then
well,
what happens
I read
is,
the fine print on that particular med.
Yeah.
And the fine print from the company in itself, there's a little asterisk, you know, when they make little claims on their stuff. And if you read the asterisk on that particular drug was to raise platelets to the target, and the target was at 50,000. Now, usual ranges for targets is 150,000 to 300,000. So if you're low, you're really low. If you're under 50, you're pretty low. His went down to 6,000.
Oh my gosh!
So,
oh my gosh! So
you know, and
And all they're going to do is hide behind the disclaimers. Well, it won't work for everybody. You know, we hear the disclaimers on TV commercials.
Right.
You know,
right.
They go on ad nauseum. They take longer to give the disclaimers in the TV commercials than they do to tell you what the drug is for.
And, you know, the thing about that, and I tell people that all the time, and I tell them, you know, you get hung up on the commercials, or you ignore the commercials, or you fast forward through the commercials if you've taped it, but you should really listen to the drug commercials because they sound really nice and they give nice pictures and everybody's on the beach and everybody's hugging each other. But if you listen, they give you all the side effects, and most of those side effects they start out with may cause death.
So the whole thing about pharmaceutical drug advertising, do you know that there are only two countries in the world that allow that, the United States and New Zealand? No other country in the civilized world allows pharmaceutical drug advertising on TV. So, you know, we could do a whole show on that. But the point being that nobody who's under that fudge umbrella is in any position to be making important decisions, including your friend. And so to the extent anyone else could have stepped in at the time and said, wait a minute, we need to think about this, let's look at the evidence and see. The other thing I say to people is I am loath to take any drug that hasn't been around for at least 5 years and used successfully for those 5 years, because you know, people talk about how, oh, it's a great new drug, and if it's going to save your life or not save your life, it might be worth the risk. But if it's under any other auspices, you wait and make sure that it's okay. The example there is Vioxx.
And that's what he was told. He was told this is your last hope. And it's
well,
like there are
case,
others.
Yeah. The only thing is your last hope. What does that mean? So if what they said to him was, it's going to cost you $14,000 for the rest of your life, and the rest of your life is going to be 2 or 3 months, seriously?
Right.
But if it's going to be $14,000 for the rest of your life, 6 years, well, okay, then maybe you figure out a way to pay. You know, you have to balance that. But the rest of your life doesn't mean anything if you don't know what that length of time is supposed to be.
That's right. Exactly. So all of that being said, I guess the moral of this story is that you have to know if you're looking at an advocate, or you think that someone approaches you and says, I'm here to help you, find out from whom they're getting paid. Would that be correct?
Yes, it would be. Although I think even better than that, to the extent we can get people to do this, and it's extremely difficult. None of us has a criminal lawyer in our back pocket just in case, and very few people have a patient advocate in their back pocket just in case, with a possible exception, and you're an example of the exception. So that exception is quite often older adult children of older parents will have a patient advocate who gets to know mom or dad or both and is there if the older child or if the child lives somewhere out of town. You know, the other side of the state or 6 states away or the other side of the country, it's great to have somebody that's just kind of boots on the ground near mom and dad, and they can get to know mom and dad. And so often people will actually have a patient advocate in their pocket for when that comes about. But, yes, at that point, even if you're stuck in a corner and you need to find an advocate, I just recommend you go to our directory, which you were talking about at the beginning of the show, advoconnection.com, and it's free. And you input your zip code, and you think the services you think you need, and you'll come up with the results of people who are accessible to you, and you give them a call, and they'll talk you through it. There's even a list of questions you can ask to vet them and make sure that they can help you, make sure that they have the experience you need them to have, and so forth. Any of that is there, so advoconnection.com. Easy enough.
That,
you can do it on a cell phone, do it on a tablet. Yep.
You founded that, right? You founded
yes,
it.
Yes, I did. I did. Yep.
And so how many people do you have registered now?
Well, it's not that they're registered. They have to apply to be in the directory. We vet them. And, for instance, they can't be in the directory unless they've been insured for patient advocacy insurance. And the insurers, because we're so new, are so risk-averse that they put them through their paces. So once they come to me with their insurance, I know it's okay to put them in the directory. And in this country right now, we only have 250 or 300 advocates across the country. We've got altogether membership in the Alliance. We have 650, but they're kind of in the wings.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So this is up and coming, new, and with healthcare and all of its changes, we're on the cutting edge of getting the information out. Is that right?
Yes, we are. I mean, here's the thing. We were sort of, it's sort of a chicken or egg kind of a thing. So we could do massive amounts of publicity about patient advocates, but people would be frustrated because we don't have advocates everywhere. And so instead what we do is we really focus where we have advocates on helping them do marketing and public relations and public speaking quite a bit and those kinds of things in their local areas. So the people in their local areas get to know they're available.
Nice. Very nice. We got a blog question, can we take one of those? We're actually, the hour's coming up fast. So do you mind, can I take a blog question at this point?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Go for it. I'll do my best.
It says, I see this happening with my elderly father. My mom is 87. When I ask what is happening with dad, I'm told the doctor changed the medicine, et cetera. I live out of state. When I ask why, there is no response or it's I don't know. What kinds of things can I do to get my mom to understand that it's important to question everything? And I would assume that that's an advocate. You hear that, the advocates hear that a lot. And I guess I asked that earlier, too, with that particular population. How do you get them to question their doctors? Is that a role of the advocate to help them or what? What happens?
To the extent you can encourage them to do that, you encourage them to do that, of course. But you're talking about, well, in her mother's case or his mother's case, 87 years of history of never asking questions. That's not going to change on the suggestion of, Mom, you need to be asking questions. And I experienced that with my own parents. I mean, my mother, who had Alzheimer's disease, My dad was told that she needed to have the battery changed in her pacemaker. And he said, so she's going in next week. Dad, what? I could hardly believe it. You know, Mom was 10 years into her Alzheimer's diagnosis. She didn't know who any of us were, and yet they were going to change the battery in her pacemaker, and he was just following along. And I said, do you know what your daughter does for a living? But, you know, we're always the kids. We're always still 12. And so to the extent you're asking an 87-year-old mom to change her habits, that probably isn't going to happen. Now, what you can do, if either parent uses a cell phone, and sometimes they do, even if it's just in emergencies, you can ask them to get to the doctor's appointment and call you and put you on speakerphone, and you can be a part of the appointment. Mm-hmm. And then to the extent you think you need somebody else to step in, you can find someone in Mom's local area and then, you know, break it to Mom that, well, I want to introduce you to this person. Maybe you go visit and do it that way. But that's exactly what I used to do. I used to, after my mom passed away, my dad was having some struggles, and he would just dial me from the doctor's appointment, and I'd be there for part of the discussion, and it worked out very well.
And that's what I do with my parents because we're in different states. And you know, I conference in on every doctor's visit, and I actually have gotten to the point where I call the doctors ahead of time, and I give them an update of what I know is happening so that they know, so that my parents aren't burdened with trying to remember to tell the doctor something.
I think that's excellent. You know, interestingly, this is a good place to mention this. One of the questions we used to get a lot from people who were thinking of getting an advocate would be, but doesn't that make the doctor upset? Doesn't that upset them that there's somebody else, that we don't trust them well enough? I call it the waiter will spit in my soup syndrome. In other words, you know, I don't want to disturb the doctor. Well, what has happened? There's been this shift, and it happened almost overnight. So 2 years ago, I could not have told you this was true. And today, I can tell you this is true. Now doctors who've worked with advocates are talking to other doctors. And now they see us as, oh my gosh, I love it when my patient comes with an advocate. I think it's great. I can't go home with my patient, but the advocate can. The advocate can make sure that the prescriptions are getting filled and that the patient's taking them the way they're supposed to. And the advocate can write down what I need to know and can make sure I have the list of drugs they're taking, whatever it is. So they feel like the advocate is their boots on the ground. And there has been this shift. And so there's no more about the waiter will spit in my soup, at least not in many areas. I'm sure there are probably still doctors out there who would be leery, but I think that it's becoming more unusual that that's true.
That's fabulous. I mean, really, most doctors at this point, you're right, are welcoming some of these changes because it is, you made the point earlier, it is so difficult for them to navigate through their own system at this point because their hands are tied. And let me just make a point, too, that a lot of doctors, you know, it's a myth to think that doctors are making a ton of money these days because they're not. That's all been curtailed and it's all been controlled and it's not that they don't make a nice living, it just means that they don't make what they used to make and it's not like it used to be. And so before you start thinking, oh wow, you know, they're falling over, they got a lot of debt, they got a lot of things to pay for because they were in medical school and then they've got continuing education and certifications and fellowships and board certifications. It's just, there's a lot of stuff there. So it's not as it used to be. So I'm sure they do well.
Yeah, there's some irony there too. And the irony is this, that you're right, doctors used to do a whole lot better than they do now. And it costs them so much more to be in practice, including paying for health insurance for their own staff.
Right.
But the irony is this, and that is that because they're making less, they are now joining into larger practices or even practices that are being purchased by hospitals. And so now the pressures on them to make more money are more than they ever were. So they're making less and they're being pressured more. And,
right.
you know, that's just the perfect storm for bad things for patients. Doctors
really
aren't any happier about it than the patients are.
That's right. And let's not forget the whole medical malpractice component of the insurance that they pay is astronomical. So they're getting squeezed to make more money. They're putting out more money just to keep their licenses and to keep them functioning as a practitioner. And a lot of physicians, that's why a lot of physicians gave up OBGYN because they just couldn't afford the insurance.
Right.
So,
well, and then we could also talk about the fact that in this country right now we're low about 25,000 primary care physicians, and that number is climbing. And one of the huge reasons for that is because, and I always say to patients, my books that are written for patients are all about put yourself in the shoes of this person or this entity for a minute. Understand what their constraints are. And if you understand that, then you understand what you need to do to get what you need. So that's what my whole You Bet Your Life, the 10 mistakes every patient makes. That's what that book is about. So what I say in this case is put yourself in the shoes of a medical student. You come out of medical school, and as you come out of medical school, you're expected to make a decision on what kind of specialty you're going to choose. And what you know is that you're going to be about $250,000 in debt. So, I mean, that's more than many mortgages, for heaven's sake. So $250,000 in debt. I can go to work as an ophthalmologist, a surgeon, a dermatologist, you know, any of those kinds of things, and I can pay that debt off in 5 years. Or I can go to work as a primary care doctor, and it will take me 20 to 25 years to pay off that debt. And so which one are you going to choose?
Right. That's
and
right.
That's why we have so few primary care doctors. That's why it's so difficult to get an appointment with a primary care doctor.
This is really disheartening. You know, it
is.
Really
it's
is.
It's scary.
Yeah.
And it's scary because it wasn't taken care of before now, and now it's on the backs of the baby boomers and their parents.
Right. That's right. I'm going to take another blog question, and then I'm going to try the board here because I'm seeing a couple of questions. I'm hoping it holds out. You need to know, Tricia, that we've had some issues with the board at times with the call, so I'm hoping that we're in good shape tonight. Blog, my son has diabetes. It took us 6 months and 5 doctors to get him diagnosed. I mean, really, diabetes? What kind of things could an advocate assist me with to lessen that time span?
Well, if this... I'm assuming that the son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And when you're going to primary care doctors, they may or may not be familiar with type 1 diabetes. Chances are they're more familiar with type 2, and they may not have even run the right tests to begin with. So typically what happens if you're having trouble getting the right diagnosis, and sometimes you don't know that except that whatever treatment is being tried isn't working. And, of course, we're all led to believe, all of our lives we were led to believe, if the treatment didn't work, it's because there was something wrong with us. It didn't
right.
occur to us that if there was the treatment wasn't working, it was because we hadn't been diagnosed properly. So in this case, if you'd, say, gone to 2 different doctors and you were still struggling and you contacted an advocate would get down to brass tacks, and they would have gotten you probably to an endocrinologist or a pediatric endocrinologist because diabetes would have been one of the first things that would have come to their head. And they're not the ones that will make the diagnosis. They're just the ones
right.
that get you to the right people.
Right, because symptoms of diabetes are, you know, that's pretty well understood. So
yes, they are, and there are tests. Oh, my gosh, all you have to do is good blood work. It's not rocket science to make that diagnosis. And an advocate would have jumped in and would have shortened that time span at least by half, if not better.
Right, right. We're going to go to the board for a minute and take a couple questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right. Let's see. Caller 4977. You're on the air. 4977.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question, and I hope it's appropriate for the show. Who has the Affordable Care Act impacted a lot of the topics discussed?
I'm sorry, I only heard part of the question.
How did the Affordable Health Care Act affect a lot of the discussion? Has it impacted in any way?
If I understand the question correctly, you want to know how the ACA, whether or not the ACA has been responsible for creating the problems that we're suffering through. Is that it?
No. I'm just wondering how it may have affected
In any direction? Okay.
In any direction.
Yeah, okay, so there are a couple of things I see. So on the positive side, that might be a negative side depending on where you're standing, the ACA allowed millions and millions and millions more people access to know more doctors. And so it makes it that much harder to get an appointment because that many more people can make an appointment and know that their insurance is going to cover it. So now on, and that might be a good thing if you didn't have insurance before, and it might not be such a good thing if you did. But on the flip side, for all of us, and we saw this in going into 2014 and a little bit into 2015, I don't want to say that it has made healthcare less expensive because we feel it coming out of our pockets more, but in effect, the cost has slowed dramatically. So even though we might see more coming out of our pockets, it's actually less expensive than it was. So those are two things that I think of right off the top of my head. And there are probably others, but as a quick answer, that's the best I'm going to do for you at the moment.
Thank you very much.
I will add, though, one other, a ripple effect of that many more people in the system. As a result of that many more people in the system, now doctors are not only harder to find to get appointments, they have less time to spend with you. And when you have less time spent with you, then there's a better chance mistakes are going to be made.
That's an excellent point. And I think we've all experienced that when we go see the doctor. We get maybe 3 minutes. I think it used to be they used to get 7 minutes. I think now they get 5 minutes. And that's all part of those constraints that you were talking about earlier.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah. They're forced to, you know, you will see X number of patients a day. And so that limits the amount of time they can actually spend with us. So
that's right.
So thank you for calling. Appreciate the call in.
Thank you.
We got another question. Let's go with caller 8796. 8796, you're on the air.
Hi, I tuned in a little late this evening, and I may have missed a few parts, but at what point do you determine whether you need an advocacy or not? While you're still looking for a cure, or while you're still trying to find out what's wrong with the person, or after you have a diagnosis, at what point?
I would say that, did you hear us talking about fudge? Fudge is fear, uncertainty, doubt, guilt, or exhaustion. And at any point in that spectrum, whether it's when you have symptoms and you've not yet been to the doctor, whether you've been to the doctor and you've gotten a diagnosis and you need a confirmation, a second opinion, or whether you're trying to choose the right treatment or even whether you'll have treatment, or even when you get your bills, when it's all said and done and you've gotten your bills, anywhere in that spectrum you can access an advocate. And if you access them earlier in the spectrum and you need a service they don't provide, they can connect you to the right people to provide the rest of it to.
I know several people who keep going to doctors and having tests done and tests done and tests done, and they're not getting any answers to what's going on with them, and they're not feeling any better.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the time to say, okay, we need help,
yes,
or you wait until you get the diagnosis and then say, now we need help.
No. Anyone who is having trouble with a diagnosis needs an advocate to make a shortcut. Advocates are well-versed. The medical navigational advocates. Those are the people who, when you go to AdvoConnection, you'll see a list of things, and one of them will say, accompany you to doctor's appointments, you know, help you understand tests and treatments, help you do research, whatever those things are. Those folks who can accompany you to doctor's appointments or help you in the diagnosis phase, that's the time to call them. That's what they're there for. And they aren't beholden to anyone. One of the things we didn't talk about tonight, but we could talk about, is the fact that if you're diagnosed with anything difficult, you need to get a second opinion. I mean, it's not even it would be nice to. It's you must, and you need to get two confirming opinions from two sources that don't know each other. They can't be in the same system. They can't be in the same hospital. They can't be in the same city because they probably know each other. They won't contradict each other. And so an advocate can be the person who helps you get to that objective second opinion. And that's what you need for your diagnosis.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call in. Tricia, I think you said something really important there. They can't be in the same system. They shouldn't even be in the same city. You know, my heart just going out. I go back to the statistics from earlier in that children and elderly. Okay.
Yes.
The children, probably their parents are going to take them somewhere. The elderly, how do they get to a different city? How does it? I mean, there's so many things here to talk about. We could do a whole other show on just how to navigate. Would you be willing to think about that?
Yes, I absolutely would. And actually, what I would do would be, with your permission, to invite one of the folks that does this on a daily basis to join us and talk about just how it's done. Yep.
That would be fabulous. I would so appreciate that. Maybe we can talk a little bit later and kind of solidify that. And
sure.
We're gonna have to say goodnight, but I want to say thank you to everybody for blogging and for calling and always for your interest. But Tricia, I can't thank you enough. I knew this show was going to be intense, but we haven't even really scratched the surface of the healthcare situation and what you guys do. So I really would like to reexamine that. I said earlier I did a two-part series on Lyme disease because it was so important, and the second part of that was the legality of Lyme and what that meant for the doctors and what they're faced with just trying to diagnose. So there, you know, I'm open to doing different facets, and I think this particular show has told me that we need to maybe look and break down certain components so that people really do understand how best to do this. Yes, it's a health and wellness radio show, and yes, we focus on a lot of things that you can do to prevent, but let's face it, everybody does have situations where they're faced with things like this, and it's important to understand how best to handle it. So with your permission, I would just love to have you back, and I would love to look at that a little bit better.
That sounds good to me, sure.
Okay, thank you. So that being said, we're going to say goodnight for tonight, but our next show, we've got a bunch of different shows coming up, and we're going to start putting out a list of what those shows are. On February 11th, we're going to talk about the health benefits of massage and what's happening there. And it's just not about lying on the table and saying, "Oh, this feels good." There's a whole lot of health and wellness as it's attached to massage, things that you never even thought about. And we've got two fabulous therapists coming on to talk about two different techniques that they use, and you'd be surprised for those chronic conditions that you've had for years and years and years how massage might take care of it as opposed to your pain meds. And then we've got a whole show dedicated to nutritional supplements and what you should be looking at and what is a good nutritional supplement versus not and how you should choose and whether or not you should actually take them. So we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about some energy healing, and we've got some other things happening, and we're going to do some things on brain health, and we're going to talk about caregivers, and we've got just a bunch of shows. So please join us. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks on February 11th. Good night, everybody. Good night, Tricia. Do you want to give your websites out one more time?
Sure. Probably the best one to find all of these things would be everypatientsadvocate.com. So there's a link to all these different things, the advocacy website, the books, everything else, right from there.
Okay, great. And remember, I'm your host, Carol Ferraci. We'll see you the next time. Check me out at naturallynutritioninc.com. Good night, everybody.